Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Yesterday was the winter solstice for the Northern Hemisphere, the Yule of long-ago ancestors. Sunday is Christmas, which has supplanted the pagan Yule celebrations of yore. In the spirit of the season, I wish to read a couple of rants I have recobbled from ghosts of Christmas past, so I should disclaim anybody else's responsibility for what I am about to say. I start with, "Come all ye faithful." Christmas, that pagan holiday appropriated from the followers of Odin, is a time for feast and fellowship, a convivial warmth against the cold winter ahead. It is a parochial celebration that affirms a civic Christianity as the national religion, although the nation is the uneasy host for every conceivable form of theology. Usually the public piety is casual, indifferently observed, but occasionally the Puritan past clamors for power, generally during periods of disruption and confusion, such as the present, when theological ideologies imprint a grim, intolerant, and despotic orthodoxy upon constitutional law. It might yet be difficult to accept willful ignorance and evangelical vengeance as the center of political direction and intellectual discourse, but the anguish that underlies American culture is a schizophrenia unable to resolve material greed with spiritual piety. The political tolerance for a variety of religions that is assured in the nation's laws is probably due more to an awareness that no one sect has been powerful enough to rule over the others. And just to be sure, religion is not allowed to directly interfere with government except as inspiration and manifest destiny. The practical consequence of separation of church and state has been to protect each from the other. By its own law, the government cannot and should not enforce or impose any manner of worship or religion upon its citizens or any others who live in this country. It cannot attempt to regulate or interfere with religion or with anyone's choice of worship or choice not to. The current debate about church and state is less about religion than it is a dichotomy of political values between those who would impose a narrow doctrine of absolutes that are not to be questioned or resisted, only obeyed, and those who believe that everyone has the right and obligation to choose their own beliefs about what is right and wrong. If the United States adopted or was forced to accept a single religion distinct from a loosely defined public creed, other religions would be purged, in particular those that are not Christian. Races other than white would lose all of their already minimal civil rights. Women would be shoved back into second-class status, and most democratic freedoms would soon be suspended. The course of the current intrusion into politics by the religious right is less to glorify God than to manipulate religion as a conduit to political power and conversion of the government into a militant theocracy. If the religious conservatives who are clamoring for absolute control of the government succeed in changing the nation into an ecclesiastical state, the result would be perpetual inquisition and religious war. As precarious and brief as has been the history of political liberty, its only real opponent is the people's belief in a divine deity and their fear they might be immortal. Religion serves as handmaiden to political rule. From the beginning of history, humanity has evolved religions to explain life and its possible place within it, and always there has been the desire that life not end at the crypt. Religion has thus been a political instrument in every society, at once a source of philosophical inquiry and a political doctrine of identity and rule. By the very nature of the fear that produced it, religion is authoritarian and exacts servitude from its followers. The hope for life after life has served secular government. The misery of life can be borne steadfastly and in service to life's oppressors by the promise of rewards beyond earthly life, which it is not necessary to prove. The dilemma of where we rank in the cosmos has been narrowed considerably to serve the ambitions of a very few who paradoxically seem to reap all earthly rewards for the pious suppression of their followers and subjects. It is double-edged. The use of religion for purposes of rule makes it essential to both regulate religion and inflict its doctrines upon government. The state supplants God, but belief in God is necessary to support the state. Nationalism is itself a virulent form of religion, but its major disadvantage is that it cannot promise life after death. Great masses of citizens believe that the nation is an extension of divine rule, however, or is an acceptable substitute. They proclaim the same fervor toward a flag as toward a deity and often confuse them. American religious conservatives used to think the conflict between the United States and the Soviet Union, righteously denounced as the evil empire, was the classical final confrontation between good and evil, and would, through the use of nuclear weapons, result in the end of Earth. Now they find other apocalyptic struggles between God, anti-God, once again crusading against Islam, reminiscent of the advent of the first millennium, while simultaneously focusing culturally inward at gay people, assertive women, and third world immigrants who transport alien gods to these shores. The Christian conservative backlash is not simply the perception of the disintegration of society as the result of the deterioration of spiritual values, but what they also perceive as a war against religion by secular government, which in reality generally accommodates religious beliefs unless arguments against them are compelling. Religious fundamentalists are rarely accommodating, but instead exhibit malevolent contempt for dissent and refuse to accept that people who think differently might be sincere and even noble in their points of view. True believers put a rather low priority on mortal life, which is only a process of mortification and putrescence to the fervently faithful. They profess a distaste for life and its pleasures and pains. They despise what is known as humanism, which is simply an ethical and compassionate responsibility for being human, but which is reviled as permissive heresy. They believe that all who claim to be Christian must support every activity that fulfills biblical prophecy, even if it destroys the rest of us. This, of course, would be the desired Armageddon and selection of souls, the so-called rapture. Good and evil would both be destroyed with the end of earth, but good would return with the reappearance of Jesus Christ. Earth would be resurrected and repopulated with the souls of the faithful who would dwell for eternity in the joy they eschewed in life. Everyone would have to die first, and everything Homo civilis has spent millennia to construct. It is ironic that the most grim, unbending, intolerant, and ignorant are unshakably certain that only they are beloved by God. It is perhaps more ironic that one would have to willfully participate in the murder of all life to be worthy of living forever. Most religions are preoccupied with death, with shades and shadows, and with few exceptions, they share apocalyptic visions of the end of earth. A wonderful yearning of spirit and intellect is distorted into oppressive sets of scriptures that stifle the inquiry that originated religions. Questions are bent into rigid answers that must not be questioned. All religions demand their followers suspend the progress of knowledge and that nothing pertaining to theological doctrine be advanced beyond the period in which a particular religion was founded. Mythologies developed hundreds or thousands of years ago are taught as absolute certainties, and subsequent learning is dismissed as heretical. A distinction must be made between religion and spirituality. An atheist can be profoundly spiritual, while a religious follower might only be so because of social pressures, ambition, or as a result of fear, which is a greater draw to the pew than the boilerplated love of God. One does not have to prostrate before a disinterested deity to be moral. Morality is a conscience of humanistic behavior. In that sense, most religions have seldom acted morally. And in this millennial era of inquisitionary fervor, the political intent of religion is immoral. The issue of church and state is much more serious than the tiresome ambitions and subversions of zealots and despots. Separation of church and state embodies all other disputes, ethnic, religious, racial, and gender, which have resulted in civil wars elsewhere in the world, but are so far contained within the normal but very strained framework of American politics. Yet the middle ground of civility and reasonability is disappearing. Comparable to the slavery issue, no matter how many compromises are erected to stall or slow the outbreak of civil war, the confrontation between religious or secular dominance of the government seems to inevitably await solution in suppression and corruption of the democratic process, and perhaps ultimately in internecine violence. Deep religious beliefs are at their core a very real human desire to exist in harmony without cant or hypocrisy. Religion, like music, has the power to bring us together despite our differences. But for most of history, it has been utilized to separate us and ensures that the majority of humanity is perpetually at war with itself. We live at a time when the incredible pace of knowledge might liberate us from idolatry and speciesicide, but instead we use what we have learned to terrify and threaten ourselves with extinction, and as a consequence retreat into psychopathic regression. We shield ourselves with fairy tales constructed during epochs when Earth was thought to be the center of everything but heaven and hell, and which we should have jettisoned with our historical adolescence. We seem unable to respond maturely to our diminished status in the universe, or to understand that our religions and gods do not adequately address the real situation of perishable life or the birth and death of stars far beyond our reach. We would destroy all that we have built and all we are rather than change ourselves into what we might be. That is the real tragedy of clinging to superstitions we have outgrown. Perhaps it is time to re-examine the legacy of the man we know as Jesus Christ and his message to humanity. Instead of a son of God predestined to die to defer human responsibility for its sins of greed, rapacity, and butchery, we have an ordinary carpenter, son of a carpenter, who for reasons that have been lost due to his deification, felt compelled to fight the slavery and injustices of his era, and attempted to raise up the poor and disenfranchised into a powerful force of revolution. If that is what he truly was, then he did not die to save our souls. He lived to make us free and was put to death for that apostasy. And that was Come All Ye Faithful, which I wrote. And now another which I wrote, Passim in Terris. Peace on Earth. Everybody wants it, though it is more a seasonal idea, traditional with Christmas bonhomme, not necessarily having much to do with the real world. The real world beats itself up every day, including Christmas. Christmas is among the very violent days of any year. Murders, suicide, drunken assaults upon family, friends, and strangers, strangling a spouse with this year's lousy tie or latest zirconium necklace, carving up the turkey, sitting at the table next to the platter, caroling groups mowed down by Uzi-carrying psychopaths, little girls and boys assaulted by merry old cherubs, mommies baking poison pies and cookies, daddies impaled on spiky plastic Christmas trees, relatives gift-wrapping cluster bombs for the kiddies, Halloween nightmares crashing down midnight chimneys. Laughter, good cheer, and full bellies exude a gaseous odor of complacency that is unable to disguise despair, hunger, and murder shrieking from outside the frames of Grandma Moses' odes to Christmas joy. Hatred and intolerance are on the rise worldwide, even as the birth of the Prince of Peace is celebrated. Falsifiers of history and theology exhort masses to exterminate minorities, a virulence never at rest, even when periodically subdued by revulsion of its excesses. Genocide wears a cosmetic of ethnic cleansing. Peace-loving peoples commit genocide upon neighbors. Large parts of the world act as laundries for ethnic cleansing. Countries or persons who publicly declare themselves as peace-loving are often as vicious as nightmarish beasts. Peace is not on the earth, but a few feet under it, for millions. Life, for so many of our human brethren, is the hell the pious claim the provenance of sinners after life. The pious are too often responsible for the living hell so many endure on earth. Genocidal advocates deny the Holocaust, yet intend the same to appease their prejudicial bigotries. The more dangerous bigots are those who think they are not prejudiced, the everyday folk who resent changes made by immigrant or multiracial newcomers into their communities, which of course in this part of the world were only recently established by displacing earlier communities. These good, decent, ordinary folk disclaim any prejudice against whoever threatens their opinions and consider their concerns reasonable, justified, and unprejudiced. Yet their complaints about differences of color or culture of their new neighbors are the same as bigots have used to inflame hatred for millennia. The prejudice against gays and lesbians is the same root fear of change as the dread of cultural imposition by immigrants. Perennially labeled citizens groups form to deny newcomers common rights and protections, as if fools, bigots, and goons are the only worthy citizenry. The so-called Christian right invokes a cultural, theological return to a Norman Rockwell past that never existed, except in the minds of the sainted Ronald Reagan and David Duke. The religious right claims a desire to return to traditional values. What are these values? Squatting nakedly around Yule fires, sacrificing animals or virginal maidens to malevolent gods? Blood sacrifices of gays and lesbians as a talisman to grim visions of power and Pentecost? Ethnic cleansing is not a stranger to America. Ever see the old Humphrey Bogart movie, The Black Legion? If you have seen it, you might recognize the inflammatory rhetoric of 100% Americanism focused against alien undesirables, which is rather familiar of late. What this country needs, the Black Legion boss tells his black hooded worthies, parallel universe Ku Kluxers, is bigger and better patriots, the cynical shibboleth, white and alt-right. An ever greater meanness of spirit pervades much of the American public since the economic collapse and election of a black president, which is apparent in the cataclysmic rise of a preposterous, bombastically ignorant, and buffoonishly pompous demagogue whose penchant for fascism barely disguises petulant, narcissistic corruption. This year, 2016, Anno Domini, marks 2.5 millennia, give or take a few years, of the birth of democracy in 508 BC. The people of Athens overthrew a tyrant and set up a government of the people, with the exception of women and slaves. Democracy is a Greek word that means rule of the people. But as pundit Mark Clifton says, the first rule of a government of the people, by the people, and for the people, don't tell the people. Don't tell them anything intelligible. They might want to be democratic. Feed them lies, sex, and violence instead, especially violence. Sex is generally banned on prime time, except on cable, but mayhem is okay anytime. Shows the little kiddies the real world they will soon perpetuate in Second Amendment delirium. America's real refugee problem is with its own citizens labeled homeless, driven out of their homes and cities by gentrified greed. How many friends and neighbors, or even ourselves, have essentially ceased being valued citizens and forcibly mutated into derelict homeless rabble treated like vermin? Imagine a homeless couple about to give birth to a child. Would they have found shelter in an empty dumpster in an alley behind an inn that had turned them away, or in an abandoned junkyard car? So now, at the birth of the baby, the reign of Herod is about to begin. Merry Christmas, peace on earth, goodwill toward all everywhere. Perhaps the camaraderie of the citizen will the season will shut out for a moment the unholy howling of hellhounds. And pardon some of my stumbling over words as I usually do. Now a change of direction. I would suppose that if you are listening to this program, you probably have a few ideas about the usefulness of public radio. Even fringe rim rants, such as I assail your ears with each Thursday morning. A much better example is provided in the next story I am about to read, which is by Irene Rasmussen of Newport, and is in tribute to a public radio station in Toledo, public radio station KYAQ, pronounced Kayak, a relative newcomer to the Oregon coast. KYAQ Public Radio, Saving Local Democracy, Why We Need KYAQ, by Irene Rasmussen. We learned a lot from the election. Certainly not all the lessons have been properly understood. A few things, though, are clear. Voters were disenchanted with the tone of the campaign, and turnout was at a near all-time low. Although by almost any economic standard, stock market, GDP, gas prices, wage growth, unemployment, energy independence, etc., the country has basically recovered from the 2008 GOP meltdown. Many people in key states did not vote to endorse Obama's remarkable achievements. They voted instead for a mysterious, ill-defined program of extreme change. The ugliness of the election turned people off. Laws to suppress turnout in key states worked. Voters in many places were intimidated, fearful, ignorant, angry, and misguided. The media failed to sufficiently inform, educate, and motivate the public. Julian Assange, the Russian government, and the FBI helped to tip the election to Trump. When the election results were announced, the Russian parliament erupted in wild applause. The KKK and other American white supremacist groups celebrated as well. The GOP helped normalize the lack of respect, dignity, decorum, and simple factuality throughout the national discourse that made this election the most corrosive in memory. All indications are that after running against insiders, lobbyists, and other denizens of the Washington swamp, these are, in fact, the very people Trump is empowering to run the country. As citizens of a state that soundly rejected Trump, we find our voices have seemingly been silenced, marginalized, and stripped of power. For us, the question now is, how do we maintain and defend real democracy? If, on the other hand, you were for Trump, and you will still want to know how well he is keeping his promises and serving you. The first and most pressing thing is to make sure that in our despair, sorrow, and depression, or our elation at change, we do not let any more of our basic assets slip away. Is there any concrete action we can take right now? Yes, there is. It is said that all politics is local. KYAQ Radio, 91.7 FM, Lincoln County's own public access radio station, is having its yearly fundraiser. Without a serious increase in sustained sponsorships and help in paying off some outstanding debt, the station will soon go off the air. Many of the election problems previously listed have to do with education, misinformation, or lack of information, problems that transcend partisan politics, problems that public radio directly address. KYAQ has been on the air for about 3 years. Sadly, it is never quite able to pay its way. This has to change. KYAQ already offers a wide range of nationally produced current events, programs like Democracy Now!, Alternative Radio, State of Belief, and many others. They try not to replicate the programming offered by other public radio outlets, like KLCC. They also offer a number of locally produced programs focused on providing live music and readings from local artists and writers, as well as information on local events. In the future, KYAQ plans to make a more focused effort to better serve the people in the local community by creating original programming more closely integrated into community needs. They hope to create stronger connections with the many groups and institutions in the area that share their mission of educating, informing, and serving the community. They can help local libraries promote literacy, help the local animal shelter match pets with people, create educational partnerships with schools, and increase public awareness of local social services. It costs only about $2 an hour to keep KYAQ on the air. Right now, donations in support of KYAQ probably have more impact than any other promotional or charity dollar you could spend. If we can keep KYAQ on the air, the station could become an even greater center for community dialogue and an engine for community development and education in the days ahead. And there is huge room for growth. I urge everyone in the community to support this important community resource. Without your support, it may well disappear. For a complete list of KYAQ's programs or to make a donation, please visit their website at http://www.kyaq.org. And that was by Irene Rasmussen, Saving Local Democracy, Why We Need KYAQ. And she is a resident of Newport and wrote this article for the Newport News Times. And now, on the same subject, I'd like to read something I wrote, which was a letter to the editor of the Newport News Times, which published it in its December 2nd edition, and slugged it with the headline, Going Where Mega Media Fears to Tread, which is the last line in the letter. In response to a letter to the Newport News Times about public listener-sponsored radio station KYAQ, in Toledo, the writer complained it did not reflect the local community, but was instead angry extreme left propaganda, anti-constitutional ideology, and has very little to do with the local community, quote unquote. He suggested KYAQ be left to die. This seems to imply that Rush Limbaugh and Lars Larson and their noxious right-wing blather does represent the Constitution and the local community. Ironically, despite the letter's unspoken claim that commercial radio might be the sole beacon of the First Amendment, a small public radio station such as KYAQ depends upon true democracy in order to broadcast, which is the financial and moral support of its listeners. KYAQ, like its sister stations, KMUN in Astoria and KBOO in Portland, is a voice that not only attempts to inform, but also to present ideas and opinions that commercial radio finds unprofitable and thus shuns as if they were a disease. Pop radio strives to reduce its audience to empty-headed children to salaciously hype the unnecessary and indigestible. Controversy and thoughtful broadcasting are anathema to so-called mainstream media. It should be understood that the single underlying purpose of for-profit radio is to make money, while small public radio stations like KYAQ scrounge around for loose change to stay on the air and on the cultural edge where mega media fears to tread. And that's a letter I wrote to the Newport News Times, which published it earlier this month. KMUN has been assisting KYAQ in its struggle to survive. I think the next few years will prove to us the imperative of public radio, and station Kayak is a vital link. This has been Michael McCusker. Happy solstice. Remember that even on the coldest winter day, the sun is aiming toward us halfway up from the equator as of yesterday. And Merry Christmas. Maybe next year we will be mandated to call it Trumpmas, the new regime of the Iron Heel.